Welcome to The Melodic Line, the official podcast of the George Lloyd Society. My name is Peter Davison, and you've just heard the opening of George Lloyd's Fifth Symphony. For this, our second episode, we are delighted to welcome back William Lloyd, nephew of George and curator of the Composer's Archive and Music Library. Hello again, William.
Hello again, Peter, and thank you again for setting this up and for making a trip to the wilds of Cumbria.
Yeah, it's always a great pleasure to be here. But I wonder, William, if you could explain to our listeners why we're in Cumbria.
Well, my wife Alison and myself, we've lived in Cumbria for about 40-odd years. And we were living in Cumbria when I started working for George in the late 1980s. And here we are, we never moved.
And today we're going to discuss George Lloyd's legacy and the importance of this archive in conserving and promoting his music and reputation. As it happens, we're actually sat in the archives studio, William, I wonder if you could tell us a little bit more about the facilities you've got here at the archive.
Well, it more or less began in about 1988 when I started working with George, and we set up our own recording and distribution company. And I was his business manager and his executive producer for a while, and then in about 1994 we took over his music library. Initially, that was just the hire and sale of scores, but before long we were doing our own printing and binding and sending scores out for performance. And after George died in 1998, we converted this farmhouse and barn up in the hills near Kendal to house the library and the whole of his archive. So we took over all the manuscripts, including all the pencil sketches and what we call the composer's copies. These are the hardbound annotated scores which are used for conducting and making recordings, and they have tempo marks and timings and a few small corrections, virtually dynamic markings, that sort of thing. But they're invaluable for anybody wanting to do a performance so that they can interpret the way he did them. Well, we still produce the full scores and all the orchestral material for performance, although over the years we've scanned most of the original masters, so we can produce copies to order now electronically. And we're about halfway through typesetting the symphonies. So the main bulk of the archive is the music library, which is hire and sales and orchestral material.
And that has worldwide reach, presumably.
It does. We send material all over the world. Since the digital revolution, it's made it much easier because we can now reproduce a score just by pushing a button from a good quality printer. We print it and bind it, and it can go off locally, but internationally the shipping costs were so great that it was always a bit of a loss sending material out all over the world for perusal, because if they didn't play it, it cost you £20-30 to send a big score to Japan and you never saw anything back for it. But now we can send it all digitally, and that works much better. Also, interestingly enough, because of the digital revolution, we find it easier to produce a new set of orchestral material printed to order and send it out to wherever it's going, especially internationally. And then we don't have the return carriage cost, which can be pretty substantial. But more significantly, we don't have to check every single part for markings. We put labels in the scores to say to people, please don't mark it up except very lightly with a soft pencil. But they're always marked in one way or another. We have to clean them up and make sure they're all right to go out again. And that's very time consuming. It can take half a day at least to check a full orchestral set. But we don't have to do that. We sell them a set, and so we don't have the return carriage cost, we don't have the marking, the cleaning, and in particular it means they can keep the set of scores and pull them out off the shelf if they need them. We get another performance. That's just happened at the Magdeburg Theatre. They were using Seventh Symphony for a new ballet, and we sold them the score. So sure enough, they're going to do it again now because they've got it in stock and they don't have to pay for it all again and hire it and go through the bureaucracy. They just pull it out of the library and away they go. So the digital change has made things much easier for us and publishers all around.
What about the original manuscripts, the George's original workings? Where are those? Are they here?
No, the British Library bought those in 2013. And they are now housed in the same room as the Magna Carta, which is very pleasing. They took the manuscripts, they took the sketches, all the pencil, what he called the short scores, the workings out, and the manuscripts. One or two manuscripts have turned up since then, but the British Library have 99% of them, I think. Mm.
And what other archive material do you have apart from the music itself?
Well, the main component is the biographical archive, and that is the correspondence is pretty extensive, and we've got a lot of photographs, press material, programmes, and various artefacts, musical instruments, and so on.
And have you catalogued everything? Is it all?
Well, the correspondence archive is huge, thousands of letters. We've done a lot of cataloguing. I have a very good assistant who's working her way through it. The point about the archive, the correspondence archive, is that George never threw anything away. So if we go through all the correspondence and just get a date and an address, we can put together a timeline of his life and what was happening and what was going on. And that's the basis for the biography, which is underway. It's a long job, but it's underway. So I think probably half the correspondence is catalogued. A lot of the more important stuff or the more interesting material is transcribed. For example, there are quite a few notables, correspondence with Henry Wood and John Ireland, Rutland Boughton, Colin Wilson, philosopher. There's a good correspondence with John Ogden, Edward Downes. So there's some interesting material there. And where we come across an interesting letter, that'll be transcribed. So it's primary source material for the biography, really. And then in addition to the correspondence, there's a lot of photographs, some of them just, as you might say, press pictures for publicity, but also at the other end of the scale, just domestic snaps of George and Nancy on holiday here and there. But then quite a bit of material from the opera, a lot of photographs of all the sessions. So almost all the recording sessions, which George did and which I did, we've got photographic record of them. So there's a lot of photographic material as well.
I also notice in the main room, a whole wall of books. What's the story behind those books?
Well, George was an avid reader. He gave as one of his hobbies in Who's Who. He gave reading as a hobby. He read quite a lot of history. He was also interested in what you might call parapsychology or paranormal psychology, a paranormal phenomenon. Although he had a sort of belief in the fairy faith, that's partly because of his mother, who was very, very interested in Cornish and Irish folklore, he was always looking for rational psychological explanations for some of these paranormal psychology things. If he could find a rational explanation, he would go for it. But if he couldn't, he was left with a mystery, and he was quite interested in these mysteries. It's also significant to me because I'm very keen to try and find something in the archive about his method of composition. We know that his composition was based on a lot of emotional content as well as purely intellectual manipulation of notes. A lot of it came from somewhere deep inside himself, but he didn't say much about it. He was very reticent about it. So any little snippets we can get from little marginal notes in books on psychology or some of his notes to himself that he wrote to give us any clues about his method of composition, that's very interesting, and that goes straight into the files for the biography. So his main topics for his reading were history and psychology, I would say, were the main consistent interests.
Thank you.
We've just heard a section from George Lloyd's virtuoso solo piano work, An African Shrine. Now, William, in the archive, I'm sure that there must be a lot of correspondence between George and various promoters and cultural figures where he's trying to get his works performed. And clearly, during the 50s and 60s, he was struggling to achieve any performances at all. So what can we find out from the archive about those conversations?
Well, that really begins after the war. Before the war, he had no problem getting stuff performed. People were queuing up to put his work on, and he had a lot of success. Then after he got hit, he took a long time to recover psychologically and physically. But also, the world had changed, and there's a long series of letters from the late 1940s, from about 1947, 48 onwards, when he wrote to every great conductor, every great orchestra in the world, sending scores, writing and cajoling and trying to get stuff on. And that's an interesting correspondence to see how he managed that. And then, of course, he got his big commission for the Festival of Britain, which was some fascinating correspondence there, because there was a two-year lead-up to that performance of the opera, John Sockman, and there was a lot of difficulty, a lot of political difficulty with the Arts Council. That's also really interesting historical material. And then after Sockman, he went through a bit of a long, difficult struggle with the BBC, who suddenly didn't want to play anything. And that correspondence is probably the most interesting to me at the moment, because it throws light on the culture wars of the time. The modernist and avant-garde schools were moving into centre stage, and George's sort of late romantic, heart on his sleeve, tuneful music was being pushed to the back as being regressive and obsolete and not music of our time. And he resisted this, and this correspondence with the BBC is fascinating. He wrote to producers more and more senior, until eventually he ended up writing to the controller of the third programme, as it was then. And he had very strong support from a senior executive at BBC West, who was a big fan, and wrote George a very interesting letter about what exactly was going on in London and why they wouldn't play his music. So that whole correspondence has thrown a lot of light onto the struggle he had, and it's prime material for the biography.
And George had his supporters as well, though, didn't he? I mean, there were people within the BBC and conductors who were enthusiastic, and eventually he started to get more performances. I mean, is that also recorded in the archive?
It is. I think one of the key figures there was John Ogden. John Ogden was an international celebrity in the late 60s, and he was a great admirer of George's music. He came to George for lessons in composition, and George learned a lot about the piano from John Ogden. It was John Ogden who managed to get a score through the net at the BBC, and George's Eighth Symphony was eventually performed thanks to Ogden's advocacy. And then when George then made his comeback in the 70s, one of the first people he spoke to was Sir Edward Downes, or then Ted Downes, because Ted Downes had been the repetiteur for the opera John Sockman, and in fact Downes had been the main channel of communication between the producer and the director, who were not speaking to each other. So George worked with Ted Downes, and through Ted Downes he made a good relationship with the BBC Philharmonic in Manchester, or the BBC Northern Symphony it was called in those days. But we eventually had a very good relationship with the BBC Philharmonic. We did about 7 CDs with them, and lots of concerts, a lot of broadcasts, and that turned out to be one of the most fruitful periods in George's life with the BBC. So they certainly redeemed themselves in later years.
Now, you've also got some quite startling artefacts here in the collection. Perhaps you could identify some of them.
Well, we have George's piano. That is an Erard piano from Paris, and there's a bit of a story to it. It was bought new in the late 20s, just at the period when George and his family moved to London so that he could start to study with Albert Sammons and later at Trinity. And they rented a big old hunting lodge in Upper Norwood, a place called The Grove. It's not there now, a big sort of Regency house. And George's father made a music room for George to practice and have chamber music and so on. And they bought this Erard piano. And by great good chance, when we moved here and established ourselves at the music library in the archive, we needed a piano tuner. And by a coincidence, the piano tuner the local piano tuner who comes to tune this piano, studied with Erard. He learned his trade at Erard Pianos in Paris, and he still has the tools, some of which he'd made in those years ago, in order to tune exactly this model of piano. Mm. So we have the piano. We also have various smaller things. We have bits and pieces, all George's pen nibs. George used a fountain pen to compose. I've got a great collection, hundreds of pen nibs and fountain pens and inkwells, all of which are the tools of the trade. And for example, there's an extraordinary eraser, an electronic eraser, which George had to rub out pages of score because he needed to change something. He used a little machine for rubbing out pencil marks. And then there's his batons and his music case that he used at Trinity. And of course, the violin, which is which was believed to belong to Emma Hamilton.
That's an interesting claim. How certain are you of that?
Well, there's another story there. When George studied with Albert Sammons, he obviously needed a good instrument. And they looked at this violin and that violin. And eventually, a friend of a friend produced a violin which was made by one of the great English violin makers, John Betts, in about 1804. And with the violin came a letter from a woman who signed herself Black Auntie, and she claimed in her letter that the violin had belonged to a Mr. and Mrs. Jeffreys, who had been butlers and lady's maid to Lady Emma Hamilton, Lord Nelson's mistress and one of the great celebrities, the most famous woman in Europe she was in her day in the late 1790s. And this had been her violin, bought for her by Lord Nelson. And then when Lady Emma Hamilton died in France in poverty, after Nelson had died, she was ostracised by society. Nobody wanted to know her. She retired to France in debt, I believe. And in order to live, she sold off her possessions. And one of these possessions was the violin. And she gave it to her butler, Mr. John Jeffreys, and told him to sell it to buy food and what she needed. But he didn't sell it. He kept it. And he passed it to the grandfather of the woman who called herself Black Auntie. And from there it came to Miss Coombs, who introduced it to George. So George Lloyd played this violin. It was a violin that he used when he was learning with Albert Sammons, and it's known in the family as the Emma Hamilton violin. And this letter is the only provenance we've tried to find out. We found a reference to these Jeffreys as a butler and lady's maid. That all fits in, but who knows? The Betts, the violin, has also been authenticated as probably by John Betts. So it's a bit of a mystery, and George is very pleased to believe it, because when George was on Desert Island Discs, when asked what his luxury would be, he chose a portrait of Emma Hamilton by Romney. So that's one of the connections with the Emma Hamilton violin.
And it's coincidentally a local connection with Romney, who was born in Kendal, of course. And Emma Hamilton became his muse as an artist.
She did indeed, and we have a plan, because Romney's father was a carpenter, joiner and instrument maker, and Romney himself made one violin which now sits about 5 miles away in the Kendal Museum, the Romney violin, and next to it is the Emma Hamilton violin in our archive here, and those two had a very close relationship. Romney painted 30 or 40 portraits of Emma Hamilton, and we're hoping to get together a small concert where these two violins come together, probably for the first time, but we like to think they might have met about 220 years ago, and we'll have them played for the first time in the same room.
Yes, that's a tremendous coincidence. George's wider family are also quite interesting in their own right, aren't they? I mean, his grandmother was this successful artist and one of the founders of the St. Ives School in Cornwall, and you've got some of these paintings and drawings from her.
Yes, well, George's grandmother was Frances Powell. She was born Powell. She became Frances Lloyd, but she was born Frances Powell, and her father was a man called William Henry Powell, and he painted some of the huge murals in the Capitol, of the rotunda of the Capitol building in Washington. Some enormous pictures, 30 feet square. And so he was a very famous artist. And Frances, or Fanny as she was known, went to Paris to learn to paint. And there she met a retired naval captain, George Lloyd, or was known as Walter, George Walter Lloyd he was. and he'd retired from the Navy, and he also gone there to learn to paint. He was 25, 30 years older than Francis, but they produced a little boy who was my grandfather, George's father. And then, unfortunately, Captain Walter died a year or two after the boy was born, while they lived in Rome. And Frances came back, and she didn't want to go back to New York and join New York Society. She wanted to carry on painting, so she moved to St. Ives, where she rented a little cottage and spent her life painting with this little infant boy. And she studied with a Dutch artist called Rekelbus, Louis Rekelbus. In particular, she learned tempera painting, and she did a wonderful series of landscapes all around St. Ives and Zenner, and these really vibrant, rich tempera colours. And then later she went on to make some symbolist paintings using the basic symbols and material from the Theosophist Society. She was a Theosophist, serious spiritual practitioner. And all those paintings have come down to us. So some are in our walls, on our walls, and some are in albums in a cupboard. But the George Lloyd Archives includes these because Francis Powell was quite influential on George, I think, and certainly his parapsychological interests, his spirituality and so on. So they're all a significant part of the archive.
And just to conclude, I wonder if you could give us an idea of why you think George Lloyd's legacy is important today. I mean, many would say he's profoundly out of step with the modern world. I mean, what you would call not politically correct. He's writing tuneful romantic music right through the modernist period, and now it sounds very old-fashioned compared to the sound of new music today. Why do you yourself commit to doing this and feel it is important?
Well, it's a difficult question, but underneath it is the fact that his music does seem to attract polar opposites, diametrically opposed views. I've hundreds and hundreds of letters from people who adore his music, and they love his concerts and his CDs and his recordings, and they write to me telling me how important it is to them and how much they love it. And we've sold 100,000 CDs. But on the other hand, there's another group at the other end of the compass, as you might say, who really detest it, and they can't see why it exists or why it should be played at all. I think that originated probably from academia. When modernism came in, the modernist music professors taught all their students that tunes and harmony and accessible music was old hat and obsolete and regressive, and the new modernist idea, the avant-garde, became the dominant force. But I think some of that is fashion, and of course the academics were tremendously influential because all their students would write what was approved, as we know from contemporary academia. The academics, the professors set the tone and the students will follow. And all the best students, of course, would go to become BBC producers and publishers and conductors and programmers and very influential in the music establishment. So sometimes it seems as if George's music is just considered not worthy by the musical establishment, but the public absolutely love it. The concerts are tremendously well received. We've had extraordinary good reviews. We've had CD of the month, CD of the year, rosettes and the guides to music, tremendous ecstatic reviews from all over the place. So it's polarized opinion. And I have a certain family loyalty, of course, because I worked with George for 10 years very closely, and spent an awful lot of time promoting his music and recording it and selling it. So I'm not really inclined to give it up, because I think its time may yet come. I think the pendulum does move. We'll never go back completely to the late Romantic style, but I think the way that George's music is considered unworthy, I think that might well change, just because I know the public like it. And one day they might get to hear it again.
And I must say, when I look around the archive and I look at the books and the correspondence and so on, I'm always struck by his intellectual seriousness, which is something perhaps a lot of people don't realise, that he was a very serious artist. He wasn't somebody in the sort of mould of Eric Coates or sort of light music, although it's very easy to apply that label. I mean, he was somebody who thought deeply about music and about the meaning of music and about what an artist was for. So, I mean, it's, you know, in a strange sort of way, people dismiss him rather easily as a lightweight, and that's not justified by the correspondence he had with Colin Wilson, for instance, the philosopher.
No, he was very serious. There are a number of keys to it. Even his harshest critics acknowledge that he's a master orchestrator. His command of the orchestra, his command of the range of every single instrument, knowing exactly what it could do, pushing it right to the limits of each instrument. That's one reason orchestras love playing it, because they all had plenty to do and they were stretched, but it was possible. A player would come up to him after rehearsal and say, "I can't play that." That would have been a deep shame to him, because he prided himself on knowing exactly the compass of the instruments and what tones and what colours and orchestral feel could be got out of those instruments. So he was serious in that sense, and he had a very vivid imagination for orchestration and orchestral colour. But I think one of the other critical points was he was serious from a philosophical point of view, that the job of the composer is, at least in part, not exclusively, to please the audience. Yes, he had to find inside himself the material that he was going to work with, but he felt that he had a responsibility to please the audience, not just because they bought a ticket, but because there's a certain experience of a large concert hall with an orchestra who are completely committed to playing these tunes, and an audience who are completely absorbed and go on this extraordinary emotional roller coaster ride. It's a single experience where everybody shares this great emotional experience. And for him, music was an emotional experience rather than intellectual experience. And he took it very seriously as a craft, that he needed to make that work. So he felt he had a kind of a responsibility. He felt he owed his audience that he should find something that they enjoyed and they really wanted to listen to.
Thanks, William, for your many insights today and a fascinating tour of the George Lloyd Archive.
Well, thank you, Peter. Thank you for coming all this way. And I've enjoyed it again, and I look forward to the next one. Thank you.
Well, let's end with more music, this time from George Lloyd's first violin concerto. Thank you for listening in.